MacCast, Sunday, September 17th, 2017. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, what a week this has been. It was Apple announcement week. We had the special event at the Steve Jobs Theater right next to Apple Park this week and found out all about new iPhones, new Apple Watch, and new Apple TV. And suffice it to say, this episode is going to be all about that. I think unusually for the show, we're only really going to cover one thing because we have so much stuff to talk about, and I'm super excited to share my thoughts and opinions with you. I know many of you probably know the bits and details of the news, what was announced by this point, and on the MacCast, what I like to do is hold back a little bit. I know there's lots of coverage right when the announcement happens, but of course, reality distortion field is still a thing, even though Steve is no longer with us. It's certainly part of all of these events, and I know I get caught up in it. I get excited or maybe upset or confused about certain announcements that happen during these events. And so what I like to do for the MacCast community is try and step back from that, take a couple days, decompress, find out all the little details, right? Because you come away and you're all excited about everything, and then suddenly the questions start to set in your mind, right? You go, oh, wait, they said that. Well, what does that mean? And what does this thing mean? And I received a lot of those questions from you via email and stuff like that. So I want to try to be able to answer those questions. I don't want to just cover what was announced and then leave you still hanging with those same questions. So I have been digging in. And I have to tell you, hundreds and hundreds of articles I have parsed through for you and hopefully pulled out the bits that you really need to know and will hopefully maybe answer your questions. I know a lot of you want to know my opinions on certain things that were announced and how I feel about stuff. We certainly will be getting into that. And we also will be hearing from some of you because I already received some great feedback. So that's going to be littered throughout this episode is your comments, my comments, and of course, the actual announcements and events and technical details and all that stuff, right? So lots of stuff to get into. If you can't tell, I'm very excited about this episode, finally being able to bring it to you. Sorry, it took a little bit longer to prep than normal, but there, like I said, there's a lot of stuff. So I say that we just dive right in. I'm going to try to go at the top, just kind of through the announcements real quickly. I'm not going to get into a lot of technical detail because, again, I think you can go watch the keynote if you haven't and you enjoy that sort of thing. It is available on Apple's website, also through the TV app and through the podcast thing. Lots of great stuff there. If you don't watch anything else, at least watch the opening 5 or 10 minutes where they talk about Apple Park and they do a really nice tribute to Steve Jobs. It made me choke up a little bit, I'm going to have to admit. And it was some really great thoughts and comments. I believe it is audio from a presentation that they gave just to employees at one point. And Tim Cook said some nice words. And plus, you get to get a look at the Steve Jobs Theater. So it's called the Meet Us at Our Place event because it is the first event on Apple's new campus, or really adjacent to Apple's new campus. There's also a visitor center there and a store. A lot of people didn't know if Apple was going to bring the famous Apple retail store. It's not really an Apple store. It's a campus store at the old facility at One Infinite Loop. They have a campus store there, and it's one of the only places where you can actually get like Apple swag, like t-shirts and pens and mugs and things like that. And a lot of people go there every year. There was a question about whether or not that was going to be part of the new campus. Well, it is. They actually have what is an Apple store there, and then they have t-shirts and things like that. I was a little bit jealous because the media that got to go there got a little special kind of early peek at that, and they did have available for sale these really cool Apple Park t-shirts in the 6 different colors of Apple, and it has the ring logo representing the spaceship, and I totally want one of those. I may have to just drive up, get my car one weekend, and just make a pilgrimage just to go get one of these cool t-shirts from the Apple Visitor Center there. And they do have Visitor Center parking. A number of the media people that went there noted that it was sort of just off the campus. But the opening tribute was great. The theater space that they have there absolutely amazing. I think Tim Cook commented that it was the most advanced state-of-the-art purpose-built space in the world. It's that space was just built for Apple doing these sort of presentations, special events. I'm sure they're going to be holding probably concerts and other things in there for Apple employees, and lots of employee events and things like that, I'm sure, are going to be going on in that space. But it is amazing. There's lots of really cool stuff there. We did get our first look at those leather seats, and they do look gorgeous. The ones that were reportedly cost $14,000 each. I have a hard time believing that, but it was confirmed that they do have power outlets down in there. And the whole exterior of the space with the fiberglass round roof that's supported only by the 44 glass panels that go all the way around, it has this gorgeous view of the spaceship campus from there. And off in the distance, I mean, everybody noted the whole campus is just surrounded by trees and green spaces, which was a big part of that build out. The campus itself is huge. I mean, the building is still huge, but what's around it, which used to be a lot of asphalt and concrete and stuff like that, all that's gone, and Apple has put in these 9,000 trees. And everybody says it's completely beautiful. And from the pictures and things that I saw posted on Twitter, it looks absolutely amazing. So they let media in kind of into the top part, and then there's these two rounded staircases that kind of go down to the main theater entrance level. And along there, the stair railing is actually carved into the granite in the walls. I think it's a granite material that's on the walls, and it looks just like it was sculpted right into the edge. Of course, beautiful, everything finely finished. And then at the top, you enter the theater, which then the seats kind of go down toward the stage. And there's, I think in the VIP area, they kind of have more bench seating that's in the same leather style. And then above that, where most of the media, I think, was sitting, is more like leather seats that fold down theater style. But just looked really great. I think it seats like 1,000 people. And then the demo area, so that area where they go in at the top, there's a great, it says Steve Jobs Theater, you know, inset into the wall or carved into the wall there. And that's actually really the only place where the name exists on the entire theater. It's not on the outside. It's just right at the entrance as you walk into the theater. But at that top level, there's a wall on the back of that. And what happens is after the event for the hands-on demo space, the people exit at the top of the theater there, and right across there is a curved circular divider wall that actually rotates back, and then the whole circular space there becomes this big open demo area. And the layout being round seemed a little bit weird to me, and even John Gruber commented it's a beautiful, amazing, purpose-built space, but it probably wasn't very practical for the size of crowd that they had. And everybody wanted to get a look at the products, and one in particular that we're going to get into, the iPhone X. And he said, you know, there just weren't enough demo units there. So, like, people were just stacked multi-layers back trying to get in there. I don't know if every event's going to be like that. This is kind of a big deal event, and there were lots of things to look at and see. So it did look very crowded, though. If you see some of those shots, it's like wall-to-wall people in there. And I'm not sure that the round space is conducive to anything other than kind of a giant mob. And I think they kind of had round tables and stuff like that. It was hard to see because really all you could see was were people. So the theater, again, amazing, wonderful. Actually, one of my favorite parts of the whole presentation was just getting to see a first look at the Apple Theater and Visitor Center. And hopefully someday, if there's people that work at Apple listening, I'd love a little tour of the new Spaceship Campus. I don't know if that's going to be possible or if it'll ever happen, but that I think that's going on my bucket list. So looking forward to seeing that. Getting into the product announcements, I think they kicked things off with the Apple Watch. Of course, talked about health and fitness features of the existing line and things like that, and then mentioned that they are adding a cellular version. So Apple Watch Series 3 is going to come in a GPS, GPS plus cellular version. With the cellular version, there's also a new version of the Apple Music app that's going to allow you to stream your music if you're an Apple Music subscriber right to the phone. So I think they said 40 million songs, I'm getting the number wrong, on your wrist. Yeah, I mean, basically the whole Apple Music library on your wrist if you want. There's some new tech in there, including a new W2 chip that is handling the wireless capabilities. 80% faster Wi-Fi, they said, 50% better battery efficiency. And the battery efficiency becomes important because they're adding some new features to the, including the cellular, things like Siri voice on the watch. So they can do all of that and fit it all in the same case. So you had to get all kinds of extra components, including an antenna in there. And they mentioned the antenna for it is actually embedded, for the cellular modem, is actually embedded right in the display. So they had to use up every inch of space to keep it exactly, well, almost exactly the same thickness. I think they said the display is 0.25 millimeters thicker than the Series 2. So just minuscule amount. And they are claiming same exact all-day battery life, which for Apple means 18 hours. They're saying you're going to get 90 time checks in there, 90 notifications, 45 minutes of app use, a 30-minute workout with music playback for that 30 minutes via Bluetooth. So if you're using your Bluetooth headphones with the music, you should be able to get all of that, plus with the standby and everything else, the watch should last 18 hours. If you're going to use it more and use more functionality, then that's going to change. Where things get really different, and I don't think this is surprising, is if you're going to be using the cellular stuff. Oh, and a surprise was that using the cellular, you are going to be able to do talking. So it's not just data, text, and things like that. You will be able to take phone calls. The thing there is, if you are talking on the watch as a cell phone, Apple's site says 1 hour battery life. So I'm assuming that means 1 hour of total talk time, total constant time, and the watch would be need to be recharged. And if you do cellular talking on the GPS version, where you're just going through being paired with your phone, you're going to get 3 hours of talk time. And I think that's the same as the current Series 2 model, if you're just looking for a comparison. Some other examples of how long the battery will last: 10 hours of music playback when you have it paired to your phone. If you're doing workouts, you can get up to 10 hours of an indoor workout, up to 5 hours of an outdoor workout just using the GPS, and that will drop to an hour if you're using the GPS and the LTE cellular. And it is LTE, so you are going to be able to get fast. There was some question about T-Mobile maybe lowering that down to 3G speeds, but they came out after this was kind of reported and said, nope, we're doing 4G. And it is limited to certain carriers in certain countries. We're going to get to that in a minute. A couple other comments on Apple Watch features that are new in Series 3. It does have a barometric altimeter, so it's actually going to be able to do elevations. Important if you're working on steps or maybe hiking, things like that. Jeff Gamet is very excited about that. He is lives in Colorado and does hiking, so we talked about that on the iOS show. Already mentioned that it is the same size. There's a couple of new colors, a new ceramic gray in the edition model to add to the white, and Apple also released some new sport loop bands. The Apple Watch is available now. It started pre-sales on September 15th, and they are going to be shipping to pre-orders on September 22nd, so just in a couple days here. As far as pricing goes, the Sport editions are starting at $329 for the Sport plus GPS. If you want to add the cellular, it's going to be another $70, so $399 US. And those are the Sport models. There are steel and ceramic models as well, but in those versions, currently, it looks like Apple's only selling the GPS plus cellular versions. So you do have to get cellular. Another thing that's being noted design-wise, stylistically, the digital crown on the cellular versions have a red dot on them. And some people have shown some aversion to that. Doesn't really bother me too much, but it does have a little red dot, I think, to distinguish it. But if you want steel or ceramic, you're going to have to go with cellular at this point. Now, you don't have to activate the cellular. Just like on the iPhone, you can have the cellular version and just turn off the cellular feature. You don't have to buy a contract. You don't have to get service for it. And that way you can save on cost and save on battery. So no worries there. Apple is also continuing to sell the Series 1, although they did lower the price of that to $249 US. And at first, my initial reaction to this was, I thought that was odd. Like, why wouldn't they do the Series 2? Why would they just phase out the Series 2 for the Series 3? And I think stepping back from it, I realized what's going on is the only difference between the Series 1 and the Series 2, if you remember, is that the Series 2 has GPS and the swim proofing. So basically, the GPS version of the 3, which is at, I believe it's still the same price as the Series 2 was. So Series 1 still is the base entry-level model, and you have the Series 3 as the next step up. And getting back to the cellular modem and coverage, you are going to need to get coverage from your carrier, and it is limited to certain carriers. I think in the U.S. it's got they have the big four, so Sprint, Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile. Internationally, you're going to have to check on Apple's website. I know it's limited depending upon which country you're in. They are going to have it available in 9 countries with 14 carriers. And as far as pricing goes, it does look like with most carriers, at least here in the U.S., there's going to be an additional charge on your plan to add your Apple Watch to your existing cellular data plan. About $10 a month, or I think it was $10 a month across the board for those big four carriers. I don't remember, I haven't checked all the way around internationally if that's how it's panning out, but that's seeming like what most carriers are doing. It is an extra add-on, and some people were disappointed by that. I was kind of expecting it, so it didn't really surprise me. Now, one thing that is a little bit surprising and may catch people off guard is that it looks like roaming is not supported at all, and the versions are country-specific. So you cannot use a UK cellular Apple Watch in Germany, for example, or you can't go from the US to the UK. And even if your current cell plan has international data coverage, it's not going to work. And it's looking like part of that is the cellular frequencies. Some of the limitations, though, do look like they're software imposed. So it could change over time. But at least currently, it's sounding like you need to be aware if you're getting a cellular Apple Watch, it really is only going to work in the country you buy it in. And that means also that you can't go to another country, buy their version of the cellular Apple Watch, and then bring it back and activate it on your local cell carrier network. So something very important to point out. And while we're on the subject of the cellular Apple Watch and data plans and coverage, I actually received this email from, or voicemail from Tim, and he had this comment about data coverage and the Apple Watch Series 3.
Hey, Adam, this is Tim from the iPad Pros podcast. I want to send a little message in about the new Apple Watch on cellular. This is something I'm really interested in as a runner. I would love the opportunity to go running, streaming Apple Music to my watch, and being able to get phone calls and things like that. This is something I am definitely in the market for, but something I'm still kind of wrapping my head around on the pricing. I am currently a T-Mobile customer, and I use one of their awesome prepaid plans that for $50 a month, you get 10 gigabytes of LTE data, unlimited calls and texts, and it's a phenomenal plan. And it has tethering, and it has everything I'd really want in a cell phone plan. It enables me to use my iPads on the go with tethering at really high speeds. And the only way to use an Apple Watch on cellular is to upgrade to the postpaid plans, and all the postpaid plans I've seen are in the $70 price range because everyone's using the unlimited plans these days. AT&T does offer, I think, a $60 plan if I go down to 3 gigabytes, something that I'm not really interested in doing. But for T-Mobile, it looks like I'll have to go up to $70 plus $10 for the Apple Watch. So I'm looking at $30 extra a month to use my watch, and that is not something I'm too excited about. So I'm going to continue to investigate options with pricing, but that is the major bummer for me, is that I can't add that on to a prepaid account, or that there aren't options for people that don't want a really super expensive cell phone plan to use the Apple Watch cellular. But otherwise, it looks like a great upgrade and something that a lot of people will get a lot of awesome use out of, especially runners. And there's a lot of cool use cases where this will come in handy. Quick note too about the new Apple Watch is the cellular edition includes 16 gigabytes of onboard storage instead of the other models that have 8 gigabytes of storage, something that may be of interest to you and your listeners, as syncing music to the watch is now a thing. And interesting that cellular model, which doesn't need to sync as much music because it can stream, has more onboard storage. So just something of note. Thought I'd send in those quick remarks about the Apple Watch cellular. And yeah, it's just a shame that the pricing is what it is. But otherwise, the Apple Watch itself, very impressed with the $399 starting price of it, and it looks like a fantastic little watch. So thanks for the great show. Bye.
Hey, Tim, I'm kind of with you, and I think a lot of people are actually with you. I think there was some hope that maybe some of the carriers would be bundling in or offering in Apple Watch support. I really never felt that was going to happen because, again, we're working with the cell carriers here, and they don't do much just out of the goodness of their heart. But luckily, I think they do stuff out of competition, and I think there's going to be a lot of competition for this business. So I have a feeling initially it's limited to certain carriers. I'm sure those were deals that were put in place between Apple and the carriers for some kind of exclusivity and stuff like that. At least that's what it feels like to me. And I think it's possible that in the future, as more people get Apple Watches with cellular capabilities, that we're going to see some competition. So maybe some of the mobile virtual network operators like Cricket and some of the second tier providers, they'll start bundling and stuff or offering pay-as-you-go options on their plans. And also, I think competition is going to pretty quickly drive the offers and the pricing and the services around this. So I can fully see, hey, come to our network and we will let you have your Apple Watch and your data bundled in with your standard plan. I think there's going to be some of that going on. And I have a feeling eventually it will roll out to the pay-as-you-go plans. Again, this is a brand new thing with Apple Watch. It's certainly going to drive adoption of using watch services on a cellular plan more. And I agree with you on the storage thing. It is interesting to see that you get more storage with the cellular versions where you probably would need it if you didn't have cellular. That's an interesting note as well. So thanks for commenting on that. But yeah, overall, I think this is a great update for the Apple Watch. We'll see how well it goes. So far, it looks like it's doing pretty well. Let's move on to the announcement for the Apple TV. We did end up getting the Apple TV 4K, adding HDR10 and Dolby Vision support for the Apple TV. So 4K plus both versions of HDR. It has an updated A10X processor. And for me, one of the bigger bits of news is it looks like Apple did work with the studios and they were able to get a deal for iTunes content in 4K. Most of the studios are on board, everybody except Disney, which really seems odd. Apple's always had a great relationship with Disney, but they're all going to sell the 4K versions at the same price as they currently sell HD for. So in the US, that's $20. It sounds like Disney's holding out because with their 4K content, they've been selling that other places for $25. So negotiations still ongoing. We'll have to see who will win ultimately on that one. I'm guessing it's probably going to be Disney. I think they're going to stick to their guns and Apple's going to want that content. So unfortunately, maybe they'll cave in though, because they'll look like the odd man out when you're shopping for that content. And the good news is a lot of the things that you've already purchased, if they make a 4K version available, you are going to get that if you've already purchased the HD, again, because the pricing has ended up being the same. So good news there if you're getting a new 4K set and you've already purchased a lot of movie content on iTunes. They also mentioned that Netflix and when Amazon Prime gets here, both of those will be providing 4K content to the 4K Apple TV. On the hardware side, one interesting thing to note, it looks physically the same mostly, but the little USB-C port on the back is gone in the new version. So why that's not there? It looks like Apple has updated Xcode to allow you to wirelessly access the Apple TV, so there's really no need to hook it up physically to iTunes anymore to transfer stuff. That was mainly a utility port, mostly used by developers so that they could sideload apps and content when they were developing it right onto the Apple TV. It's looking like you're going to be able to do that remotely, as well as grab screenshots and do screen recordings in QuickTime over the wireless network. So that is great, because for somebody like me who's a podcaster, maybe want to do a video thing where I'm going to show you a demo of something on an Apple TV, I'm not going to have to disconnect the Apple TV and all the cables from, you know, my television, which can be, depending upon how you've routed your cables, can be a pain, and bring that into my, you know, into my office and hook it up to my computer. I'll be able to do all that remotely over Wi-Fi, and that is going to be awesome. The pricing on the base level model has gone up $30 US. It's coming in at $179, and that's for the 32 gigabyte version. The price for the 64 gigabyte version has remained the same. It's $199. Both became available for pre-order this past Friday and are shipping on September 22nd. Should be available in retail stores at that point as well. And it is coming out in the US first, followed by Canada and Australia later this month, and then additional countries, UK, France, Germany, Sweden, Norway, later this year, and then future, we don't know at this point where else it will be rolling out, but that will be sometime next year. And that's it for the updated Apple TV. Next up was the iPhones, and Apple kicked things off with the iPhone 8. Yeah, that was a little bit of a surprise. So it wasn't the iPhone 7S, 7S Plus, but they actually went straight to the 8 naming convention. Overall, the design is updated with glass front and back, still in silver, space gray, and gold, although they look a little bit different because of the whole glass. The glass is very interesting, too. It's reinforced, Apple says, with laser-welded steel and copper structure. So I'm assuming that's microscopic because you really can't tell. And they claim it is the most durable glass ever in a smartphone. So I have no doubt when these get in the hands of reviewers next week, we're going to see many, many videos with the classic drop tests. So that will be put to the test. So Apple making that claim is not insignificant because they know it's going to be battered and abused. The display sizes are still the same, 4.7 for the iPhone 8, 4.7 inches rather, and 5.5 inches for the iPhone 8 Plus, although they are updated displays. Apple's calling it the new Retina HD display. It is also a True Tone display, so Apple bringing their True Tone technology into those. It has new stereo speakers, which Apple claims are 25% louder, which is a good thing, and also offer deeper bass. As far as the processor goes, it has an updated A11 Bionic processor. Yeah, Apple marketing is... they've stepped up their game this time around with the marketing terms. So we have a Retina HD display and a Bionic processor. And a lot of these things are to denote sort of the technologies that are in them. In the case of the Bionic, it has a new neural engine, which is going to be used for Apple's artificial intelligence and machine learning algorithms inside iOS. We'll talk a little bit more about the neural engine and where that applies to some of Apple's other technologies here in a second. But as far as the processor goes, all new Apple design processor, the A11 Bionic. It's a 6-core GPU, 4.3 billion transistors. It has 2 high performance cores and then 4 high efficiency cores, and of course the operating system manages all of that. This is also the first iPhone or series of iPhones that's going to have an Apple designed GPU. This is a 3-core design. Apple claims it's 30% faster than the GPU in the A10 Fusion chip, but uses half the power. So Apple designing all of their chips and things is all about eking the most performance to kind of power ratio out of their systems, and they seem to have pulled it off big time this time around. At least, again, these are all numbers from Apple. We're going to have to wait for real-world testing, but they do say the GPU is designed for high-end applications, photo applications, games, and certainly optimized for Apple's new Metal 2 technology. So we can expect some amazing things out of this GPU. And then finally, it also has an Apple-designed image signal processor. So for photographs and for all the photo stuff, Apple says it's going to be much faster in low light autofocus. It's going to have an improved pixel processor and a hardware multi-band noise reduction system built into it, or filter, I guess that probably is. What all that means to you and I, better, faster, better looking photos and camera stuff. And the camera systems also got an upgrade. There's a new larger 12 megapixel sensor in the rear-facing cameras. The front-facing camera is a 7-megapixel true depth design, and they're also adding in a new slow sync flash to the camera system. This is a digital slow shutter speed that is achieved by using short bursts of light to even out the background. So what this is supposedly able to do is kind of, if you've ever seen one of those cool photos where you have It's low light. Typically, you have the person in the foreground. They're in sharp focus, but their movements or the background stuff in the background that's moving is kind of blurred. It's this cool professional photo effect. Supposedly, you're going to be able to pull that off with this new slow sync flash. Again, we're going to have to wait to see how these things actually perform in the real world, but Apple building in the technologies to allow us to do it. Another big part of the new camera system in the iPhone 8 Plus is new portrait lighting. This is going to be released as a beta. It's software like the beta for the portrait mode that they added with the iPhone 7 Plus. It's going to use the depth map and systems in the new camera sensors to separate the subject from the background and then apply machine learning to different areas of the face to apply virtual lighting. So just like if you were in a studio and were able to set up all kinds of different lights to achieve different lighting effects over the facial contours and things like that, it's going to be able to apply that in software in real time. And it is added after the fact, so it's non-destructive. You'll actually be able to go back to the original or apply the effect or even change the effect later. And again, this is going to ship when the iPhone 8 Plus ships. They've also enhanced the video with a new Apple-designed video encoder. Apple says that they can separate your video images into 2 million tiles and process those 2 million tiles every second to analyze the image for what's going on, what kind of motion's in there, what elements are in there, sky, grass. It's going to detect all of those things and be able to better optimize the compression in your video, giving you higher quality, better quality videos at a smaller file size. So again, Apple doing everything from the software to the hardware big time with this update. And that supposedly is going to allow them to also bring us 1080p HD video in 240 frame per second slow motion. So very high rate slow motion at very high quality, something a lot of Apple's competitors don't have at this point. So if you're into video, if you're into photography, this updated version, especially of the iPhone 8 Plus, is amazing. And they've also optimized the camera system, no surprise, for augmented reality. They have new gyroscopes and accelerometers in there. They have the true depth system. Software has been tuned for doing advanced motion tracking, and they showed off a couple of augmented reality demos. We saw the game demo thing again, which of course is amazing with AR kit and stuff like that. But the one that actually blew me away the most is they mentioned that the MLB At Bat app, and I'm not even a sports guy, and I got excited about this. It's going to have this ability when you're at the game, you could hold up your iPhone and it will actually detect the players and their positions on the field and pop up information right above them. So you see an image of the player, you'll be able to tap on that, get stats and information from the game while you're right there, all in augmented reality. And it's all being enabled by that combination of hardware and software that Apple is putting together. And I thought that was blowing me away. I think I said this in the past. I'm very excited about all the fun applications of augmented reality, but I'm even more excited about these really practical applications that are going to be useful when you're actually out and about and doing things. I mean, to be able to do that at a baseball game, you know, it's like having a sort of virtual television with you and in front of you, but you're live there at a game. I thought that was really neat. And that was something that impressed me when they were showing the different slides and talking about the features. On the wireless side of things, there are some updates. The new phones are going to support Bluetooth 5 and the bigger deal, wireless charging in the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus models, fully supported in the Qi standard. So this is a standard that's been out for a while. It's something Apple actually uses in the Apple Watch, but that version is tweaked, so you can't use just an off-the-shelf charger. They're not going that route with the updated iPhones, which is very exciting. So this is going to be huge, I think, for adoption of wireless charging, especially in public spaces. But it also means for us that you're going to have a lot of options when it comes to wireless chargers. Now, it's my understanding, though, out in the marketplace, not every charger that supports the Qi standard is created equal. So a lot of times you'll get what you pay for, it sounds like. You're probably going to want to go with a more reputable supplier and not just a cheap Chinese knockoff when you're looking for HE wireless charger for your high-end iPhone. I think really what gets impacted is the charging rate and how well it does. I don't think necessarily that they're unsafe or anything like that, but it just sounds like certain ones do a better job than others, and usually it's related to the price that you're paying. So just be aware of that. They did also show off a charging pad of their own that they're working on. That's not going to be out right away. And a new AirPods case that is going to support wireless charging. Now, reportedly, the new case for your AirPods is going to be $69 and may come out in December, according to some sources. Although on Apple's own iPhone product page, it does say that the AirPods with wireless charging capabilities are coming in 2018. And it's not clear if Apple is going to update the AirPods that they're shipping out to include the new wireless charging case, or if it's always going to be an add-on. But if you already are an AirPods owner, it does sound like you're going to be able to just get a new case. And I think you can actually buy a replacement AirPods case right now in the current design, and it's that $69 price. So I think that's why it's at that price point. Now, a big question that I received from many of you after this announcement was, with wireless charging, am I going to be able to charge through a case, or am I going to have to use my iPhone naked to actually be able to get it to charge? And the answer is that the Qi charging standard should work through a distance of up to 45 millimeters, or through materials up to 45 millimeters in depth. So the iPhone itself, that, you know, sort of the back plane before you get to the charging sensor inside, and the plastic and any charging pad, that's going to be about 7 millimeters of thickness. So that would leave you with almost 35 millimeters, which is 1.37 inches of thickness, to be able to get charged through. So unless you have some weird case that is really that thick, I think in most cases you're going to be just fine charging through any case out there, as long as that case isn't metal. Metal will screw it up and block the signal. So you're not going to be able to use your aluminum or your steel case, but if you're using a standard plastic or leather case, it should charge through that just fine. And the iPhones are going to be available in 64 gigabyte and 256 gigabyte sizes. There is no 128 gigabyte version, and they're starting at $699 US for the iPhone 8 and $799 for the iPhone 8 Plus. Again, pre-orders started this past Friday. They're starting to ship on the 22nd, and iOS 11, which is also coming out, that's going to be shipping September 19th. So just in a couple days as I record this podcast, it may already be out by the time you hear this. And then something that was really great in this event is Tim Cook did utter those famous words, and he did note, they don't use them lightly, that there was one more thing. And that one more thing is the iPhone 10. It's the letter X, the Roman numeral X, but pronounced iPhone 10. And it is, as expected, the edge-to-edge display version. It's going to be available in two colors, space gray and silver. It has a Super Retina display, and what that means is that it's 2436 by 1125 pixels, 458 pixels per inch in terms of the pixel density. That's the highest density Retina display Apple has ever produced, thus earning it the Super Retina display name. It is 5.8 inches, a little bit narrower actually than the iPhone 8 Plus screen, but similar in height, and you are a little bit taller actually, I believe. And it is True Tone. It has Dolby HDR and support for HDR10. So it is a 4K display, and it looks gorgeous. All the reviews, it is OLED as expected, so super rich blacks. Apple says it has a 1,000,000:1 contrast ratio, whatever that means. I don't think your eye can detect something that high contrast, but maybe, all right? It's an amazing display, and everybody that went into the hands-on area and has been able to get a look at it says it is unbelievable, by far the highest quality display Apple has ever made. But it also does mean that there is no home button. The home button has gone away, so there's a whole new way to interact and work with the iPhone. It has sort of this little bar hint at the bottom where you're going to swipe up. You'll be able to tap to wake the display, and in addition to using the raise to wake feature, You swipe up from the bottom and that will take you to the home screen, and you'll do that in any app that you want. If you swipe up and sort of pause for a second in the middle, that's going to activate the application switcher, so you're not going to need to do that. The sleep wake button has been rebranded as the side button, just like on the Apple Watch, and you'll use that for a number of functions, including holding that to activate Siri. I'm a little bit curious if that could cause that to go off maybe in a pocket or something like that, but I think they're probably using the proximity sensors to note that, hey, it's face down or it's in a pocket or something like that, so don't activate Siri at that point. You're going to be able to double tap the side button to activate and use Apple Pay. And for as far as what happens with Touch ID, as expected, Apple introduced Face ID. So it is facial recognition. They're using the what Apple is calling the True Depth camera system. So the thing that many refer to as the notch or the sensor bar, Apple says is the True Depth camera system. It has, I believe, an array of 7 different sensors if you include the speaker and the microphone. But as far as the camera system, it has an infrared camera, something Apple is calling the Flood Illuminator, the front camera, and an infrared dot projector. And so the way this works is when it's doing facial recognition, it turns on the Flood Illuminator, which is basically an infrared light to illuminate the scene. Then it projects 30,000 infrared dots onto your face. It uses that to create a wire mesh and mathematical model of your face, or I think actually it's probably a dot model, basically a mathematical model of your face, processes that with the neural network chip that is in the A11 Bionic, or the neural engine that's in the A11 Bionic chip, and then stores that in a secure enclave. And then when you go to unlock your phone, it does that same process again. It and then analyzes that image, takes that image and compares it to the one that is stored. And Apple built their system training it with AI and machine learning. They said they used over 1 billion facial images to help train the system, and basically are assuring us that it is bulletproof. All of the data and processing stays local to the phone. It's never sent to the cloud. Apple never receives that. It's encrypted and stored in the secure enclave. And yes, it will work in the dark because, again, it uses IR technology, same kind of technology that's built into night vision. So it will work perfectly. It should work perfectly in the dark. It doesn't matter. It doesn't need light. Again, it's using its Flood Illuminator technology, which is invisible as near as I can tell. It's not like you're going to see a light in your face. This is all happening in infrared. Now, you do need to look at the phone to unlock it. This is something that Apple calls attention awareness. So if you're not looking at the screen, it won't unlock it. There's a little indicator in the user interface in iOS 11. It has a little lock when you're on the lock screen. There's a lock icon. When you look at it, give it your attention, it does the facial recognition. It happens almost instantly, and it will become unlocked. Now, it doesn't jump right to the home screen, and Apple says the reason for that is so that you can look at the time, you can look at notifications and other information that might be on the screen. You still have to swipe up to go to the home screen. So you swipe up from the bottom, it will go to the home screen. You also do need to have your eyes opened. So there is at least some iris recognition, not retinal scanning or anything like that, but iris recognition to know that, hey, you are looking at it. It does have your attention. And some cool things are actually being done with that. They say it will even lower the volume of an alarm or a ringer once it has your attention. So it knows, all right, you're aware that you just got a phone call or there's an alarm. I don't need to be so loud, which is kind of cool. That's a nice little feature. I don't know if it can be tweaked or disabled. One question I almost immediately had was, well, what about people who suffer from issues where maybe they can't give their attention? Maybe you have motor disabilities or visual issues and you can't do that. What are you supposed to do there? It turns out there is an accessibility mode where you can disable the attention awareness feature. It kind of stinks because you have a little bit reduced security in those scenarios, but at least Apple thought about it and you are going to be able to disable that and still use the facial recognition. Obviously, you can always fall back to a passcode. You're not required to use Face ID, so you could just use a passcode as another option. And then some people were worried, well, what happens if someone is trying to steal your phone, or if law enforcement is trying to get into your phone? Couldn't they just show the phone to your face and then it would be unlocked and they would have access? Apple has put in a squeeze to disable feature. So basically, if you press and hold down on the buttons on each side of the phone for a few seconds, that will lock the or disable temporarily disable the Face ID until you actually enter a passcode. So you can do that. And again, all of this stuff is processed almost instantaneously by the neural engine that's built into the A11 Bionic. The immediate question a lot of people, myself included, had was, okay, how is the security on this? Is it as good, if not better, than Touch ID? And Apple gave some numbers out during the keynote. They said that with Touch ID, there's a 1 in 50,000 chance that somebody could use their fingerprint instead of yours to unlock your iPhone. I had not realized that. That, to me, didn't seem like it was that secure. But 1 in 50,000... The odds of somebody just randomly unlocking your phone with their fingerprint, not very good. Apple claims that with Face ID, it's 1 in 1,000,000 chance. Now, that number gets reduced if you have somebody who has shares some genes with you. And they did note that if you have a twin, it can be fooled by identical twins. So hopefully your twin isn't evil and isn't trying to get into your phone. But if you're worried about that, you may not want to use Face ID on your iPhone, and you might want to stick with a passcode. But hopefully, if you have a twin, they're nicer than that. Apple called them evil twins. Only evil twins would be trying to get into your phone. They did a lot of work and testing on this. They were very specific, saying it cannot be fooled by photos. And they even said they partnered with some of the top people in Hollywood to create masks, basically latex masks of people's faces, and they coded against that too. So you're not going to be able to fool it with a mask. So if you see that in a future heist movie or something like that, that's pure Hollywood. Apple says no chance of that happening. Although I have this feeling that once hackers and people get their hands on this, just like they did with lifting fingerprints and making fake fingerprints for Touch ID, someone is probably going to figure out a way to fool the system. It's going to be next to impossible, and I don't think it's something that anybody needs to worry about, but I fully expect a year, 2 years from now, someone's going to figure it out. It's going to be a cat and mouse, as it always is with this kind of technology. Another big question people had is, what happens if I have sunglasses? Will it be thwarted by that? Am I not going to be able to use it with sunglasses? Craig Federighi says, nope, you can use it with most sunglasses, again, because it uses infrared light. So assuming your sunglasses aren't blocking infrared light, you should have no problem. If you unfortunately do have an injury or a disfigurement due to an accident, or if the structure of your face changes significantly due to, say, facial reconstruction surgery, yeah, you're going to have to retrain it. It's not going to be able to adapt to that. But normal changes, you put on different makeup, you change your hairstyle, you grow a mustache or a beard. Apple was very specific about saying that's not a problem. It will learn as you age. If you gain weight, it's going to figure all that stuff out over time, and it will be able to adapt to that. It does require a passcode after 5 unsuccessful attempts. So if you pick up your phone and suddenly realize that it's not accepting Face ID, chances are maybe somebody was trying to get into your phone when you weren't around. It might be a little bit of an indicator. The data itself is also not an image. The thing that's stored, as I mentioned before, it's a complex mathematical model that is encrypted and stored in the secure enclave. And the reason this is important is two reasons. One, again, Apple doesn't have any of your data. It's on your phone. And even if a hacker got a hold of your phone, if somehow they were able to reverse engineer the secure enclave, they were actually able to get into that mathematical data of your face, their ability to reconstruct an actual exact facial image or facial model from that information would be nearly impossible. So a lot of people are worried, well, what happens if someone steals my face, basically, and starts using that for other things or other nefarious purposes? I don't know what they would do with that information. Maybe trying to get into another locked device that you might have. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Very, very unlikely. So just be aware of that. Another kind of odd security thing that came up in Apple's app guidelines is that they said that if you're developing an app and it's going to target users that are 12 years old or younger, so basically anybody under 13 years old, you have to give a way to interact with it that doesn't require Face ID. Basically, you can't require Face ID for anyone who is under 13 years old. I assume this is somehow related to the Children Online Privacy and Protection Act, to COPPA, but I don't really know. It seems kind of crazy on many levels. Most specifically, I don't know how a developer would know how old a person using their app was. It's a weird thing to be in the app developer guidelines. I'm guessing maybe it ties into the family plans in iCloud, where I do believe that you set the age of your children when you add them to your account. So maybe apps have to tap into that. This one's a little bit odd. I'm going to try and follow up with some developers on this and see if I can get some more information. But just be aware, apparently, if you're 12 years old or younger, you're not supposed to be allowed to use Face ID for some reason. Another big question a lot of people had with Face ID is, what about third-party apps that are already supporting Touch ID? It sounds like anything that does Touch ID now will work right out of the box with Face ID. Developers aren't going to have to rebuild a new version of their application. Somebody asked me, well, what about the user interface? Because I know, like, in 1Password, it has the little fingerprint icon, and that's how what you tap on to enable Touch ID. I'm guessing all of those assets will be swapped out. I think this is all part of the biometric APIs that are built into iOS, and with iOS 11, I'm sure all those assets and things have been tweaked. It's going to detect, do you have a phone that's Touch ID or Face ID, and just swap those things out automatically. So I don't think we're going to have to worry about that. Final thing a lot of people have asked about Touch ID, or Face ID rather, is, can you put in more than one face? And it looks like, at least initially, it is one face per iPhone. So you're only going to be able to put your face in there. You're not going to be able to add the face of a spouse or a child or something like that. They're going to have to use your passcode if you want to allow them to have access to your device. Some other fun things that Apple is doing with the camera system: they did show off what is now being called an emoji, a whole new set of emoji that will allow you to use your emotions and apply them to a 3D animated emoji that you can then add to your iMessages, like stickers or little messages. And they had a bunch of different characters. I'm not going to be able to recall all of them, but I know there was the robot and the chicken, cat, dog, bunny, and of course the poo emoji, because you definitely want to be able to send your friends and family versions of yourself as the poop emoji. And something that was cool about this is the facial tracking just looks amazing. And also, you can record audio with it. So you can send messages, basically turn yourself into a little emoji puppet. And I think it's a lot of fun. We'll have to see how useful it ends up being in the long run. I already mentioned some of the new controls as far as, you know, switching between apps. You're going to swipe up from the bottom of the screen and kind of hold. That left the question, well, what happens to Control Center? Well, Control Center is now going to be a swipe down from the kind of right ear on the iPhone. So I mentioned it does have the little notch sensor bar and the little areas on the left and right, at least for some people, they're being referred to as the ears. I think that's the easiest way to refer to them. So we'll do that here on the MacCast. But swipe down from the right ear will bring up the new Control Center interface in iOS 11. Swipe down from the left-hand ear, and you will get the Notification Center. So that's how you access that. Moving on to the camera system in the iPhone X, dual optical image stabilization on the rear camera now. So it used to be, I believe, just the wide angle had the optical stabilization. Now both have optical image stabilization. The front side has the true depth camera on the EyeSight camera. And I know Apple's not referring to it like that, but I have a hard time mixing up front facing and rear facing. Basically, the rear facing camera that has the telephoto lens and the wide angle lens. The telephoto camera lens has been updated to an f2.4 aperture. That's versus the f2.8 aperture that is in the dual camera system on the iPhone 8 Plus model. So a little bit better telephoto. And the front camera on the iPhone X is also able to do those new portrait effects. So the front-facing FaceTime camera can do portrait effects as well as the rear camera. On the iPhone 8 Plus, you're only going to be able to do it with the rear-facing camera. So a little bit of distinction between the two models there that I wanted to make sure that I pointed out. As far as battery life goes, it's going to have a little bit better battery life than the iPhone 7, iPhone 8, 2 hours longer on the battery life there, but a little bit less than the iPhone 8 Plus. I think about 2 hours less battery life. And as I mentioned, Apple did give a sneak peek of the wireless charging mat. This iPhone, the iPhone 10, of course, has the wireless charging, same as the iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus. The new wireless charging mat that Apple is putting together, they're calling the AirPower mat. They say it will be available sometime next year. And the thing about Apple's mat is that it will allow you to charge up to 3 devices at the same time. So you could put your iPhone on there, iPhone 8, 8 Plus, or iPhone 10, an Apple Watch Series 3, and it does look like it only supports the Apple Watch Series 3, and the new AirPod wireless charging case when it becomes available. All three of those things you could put on the same pad. Typically, most Qi chargers is one pad, one device. And what's enabling this, it seems like even though Apple's using the Qi wireless standard in these devices, what enables the AirPower pad to work is Apple has kind of extended the Qi standard to support these multiple devices, and they are part of the Wireless Power Consortium. So there's a question, is Apple going to give this technology back to that consortium, or are they going to keep this solely for Apple products? I would, based on past things that Apple has done, I would think that they're going to keep AirPower for themselves, but who knows? Because they are supporting the Qi standard, maybe they're more willing to be open and to give this back. And we might see third-party chargers that support that. But my guess is it's going to be more of like an MFI licensing thing. And if you want to pay the license, Apple will let you license AirPower if you want to sell a thing. So I fully expect that in the future, there'll be AirPower pads from people other than Apple. But at least initially, it's probably going to be a purely Apple product and probably come with a purely Apple price. We don't know anything about pricing. We don't know actually when it's going to hit the streets. Just Apple has said available sometime next year. Now on the iPhone 10, Apple did push the pre-order date back further. We don't know exactly why. There's a lot of speculation on this. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But if you want to pre-order an iPhone 10, you're going to be able to do that on October 27th. And they will start shipping them on November 3rd. Just like the iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus, the iPhone 10 comes in 2 storage sizes, 64 gigabytes and 256 gigabytes, starting at $999 US for the 64 gigabyte model and $1,149 for the 256 gigabyte model. So definitely the highest priced iPhone we have ever had. It is not cheap, folks. And then just lastly, with all of the iPhones, Apple is continuing to sell a number of other models of the iPhone. They have the iPhone SE, which got a price drop, 32 gigabytes for $349 US, and 128 gigabytes is now $449. They are continuing to sell the iPhone 6S, $449 US for a 32 gigabyte, and $549 for the 128 gigabyte. And they're also selling the iPhone 7, 32 gigabytes for $549, 128 gigabytes for $649, and the iPhone 7 Plus models, 32 gigabytes, $669, 128 gigabytes, $769. So now you can buy an iPhone SE, an iPhone 6S, an iPhone 7, an iPhone 7 Plus, an iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, or an iPhone 10. Yeah, I called this the Performa series of iPhones. This is way too many models, if you ask me. I am not sure what Apple's doing here. I guess they're trying to cover every price point, every feature under the sun. To me, it's a little bit confusing. I think we could at the very least probably drop the iPhone 6S models and just go with the SE, iPhone 7, 7 Plus, iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone 10. I would like to see it even further reduced, but I guess Apple maybe knows what they're doing when it comes to this stuff, because they've been pretty successful at selling iPhones. So we'll have to see. I don't expect all of these models to remain around for too long. I'd be surprised if they make it the whole year, but maybe we'll just have to wait and see. But that was all of the big announcements. A few other odds and ends that I want to talk about, what I'm calling the other stuff. It does look like Apple is no longer selling any of the Product Red models, at least currently. Again, I would expect those to come back, that color choice. Apple has supported that charity for a really long time with its products, so I assume we'll be getting versions of those probably in the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone 10 editions. It's probably just a fact of they wanted to get certain versions out, and they're limiting the colors and styles so they don't have to produce so many cases. The button stuff on the iPhone 8 and iPhone 10, I just want to mention all the different ways you can use that new side button. We already talked about pressing and holding to get Siri, double-clicking for Apple Pay. If you want to take a screenshot now with the iPhone 10, what you're going to do is you're going to hold the side button and the volume up button, because again, no home button to press anymore. And then accessing accessibility features, if you enable that option, it is going to be a triple click on the side button where it used to be a triple click on the home button. For the wireless charging, the new phones are supporting fast charging, 0 to 50% charge, Apple says you can get in 30 minutes, but there is a pretty big caveat. You're going to need a wall charger that's at least 29 watts, and that means the only way to get that is Apple's 29-watt USB-C charger, which is not going to be in the box. It is going to be an extra charge. $49, I believe, is what Apple sells that for. And then you're probably also going to need a USB-C to Lightning cable, which I believe is another $29. So you're going to be looking at an additional $70 if you want to be able to do the fast charging. Now, if you already have a USB-C MacBook or MacBook Pro with the 29-watt, 87-watt, and I think 60-watt chargers. I don't remember all the wattages there, but any one of Apple's USB-C chargers is going to work to be able to do the rapid charging on your iPhone 8 series or your iPhone 10. So be aware of that if you want to do the quick charging. That's never been a big deal for me. I've just kind of felt, you know, I plug it in, standard charger, and it charges up overnight or at the end of the day, and I get through a day without having to really charge it, or I charge it in the car. So I've never seen the need for rapid charging, but if it's something you want, it is going to be an option. Another thing I wanted to point out, because some people who were on the iPhone upgrade program when the 7 came out, so going from the 6S to the 7, they discovered that one, they had to go through a whole new credit check, and two, they had to go into the Apple store to trade in their phone, and three, that meant they weren't available to do pre-orders right when the iPhone went on sale, and because it sold out so quickly, a lot of people weren't able to upgrade for several months. And we talked about this as being a problem, one of the reasons why I wasn't a big fan of the upgrade program. Looks like Apple learned some things this time around, and they were offering for the iPhone 8, and I'm assuming that they're going to do this for the iPhone 10 series, that if you do want to go with the upgrade program, you can kind of get pre-approved. For the few days before the iPhone 8 went on sale, you could go on the app, the App Store app, and get pre-approved for your iPhone upgrade. And Apple was also even offering a trade-in kit. They would send you a prepaid shipping label to return your old iPhone to Apple. That meant you didn't have to go into the Apple retail store to complete your upgrade process. So they did this in advance of iPhone 8 pre-ordering. I'm assuming they're going to do it in advance of iPhone 10. We'll probably have more information sometime in October. But if you are on Apple's iPhone upgrade program, I thought that was pretty good news. There's also a new case for the iPhone 10. Apple's calling it their leather folio case. It kind of looks like a smart cover for your iPhone 10. So it has a little flap that comes over the front screen, and it does have the ability to sleep and wake as you open and close the cover. It is $99 US, and it's going to come in four different colors: Cosmos Blue, Taupe Black, and Berry. Little quiet thing that happened in the background as Apple's event was going on is they quietly raised the price of the higher capacity iPad Pros. The 10.5-inch and 12.9-inch models all got a $50 price increase for the 256GB and 512GB models. And the reason that seems to be happening is because of flash storage prices going up. Basically, flash storage is getting used up by Apple and a bunch of other companies, becoming a little bit rare, and prices are going up. So Apple is raising the prices to go along with that. I have a feeling that's also why we saw some additional price increases across the iPhone line and stuff like that this time around. Typically, Apple tries to keep the price about the same, but if their prices go up, that typically gets passed on to us, the consumers, and that does seem to be happening. There was also a new set of wired headphones that came out this past week, the UR Beats wired headphones. They're available in 3.5 millimeter and lightning versions. So if you want a set of wired headphones from Beats, you can get those now, and or you will be able to get those rather in the fall. Excuse me. They are going to be selling for $99. And then also finally, with the Apple TV 4K, there is a new Siri remote. The only difference, as near as anyone can tell, is there is a white little ring around the menu button. And I'm assuming that's to help with the whole orientation issue. It doesn't look like it lights up, so it's probably not going to help that problem that a lot of people have where they don't like the Siri remote because it's hard to read in a dark room. But Apple is also dropping the price of the Siri remote. So if you've broken yours or need a replacement, it's now going to cost you $59 US, where it used to be $79 US. And it does look like the 4K Apple TV is shipping with the new Siri remote. So that was all the latest from the event itself. A couple of other things to talk about. iTunes 12.7 was released, and I'm bringing this up mainly because there's a pretty big change in here. Apple has quote unquote streamlined the iTunes there, the new version of iTunes, and they removed the App Store and app management completely, along with a few other things that got moved around. So internet radio is now looks like it's still in the sidebar, but it's also part of Apple Music in the radio section. You're not going to be able to find it, though, in the little drop down anymore, nor can you put it in there. I think that was an option when you checked it on. And iTunes U content, some of the iTunes U content has been moved into podcasts. So you either need to access, if it's courses, I think you access it from your iTunes U app on your iOS device. You're not going to be able to get that in iTunes anymore. And then the other kind of content that's more like podcast content you can get from iTunes U, that is now in the podcast section. So if you have that content, that's where it has moved to. And then also ringtones have been removed from iTunes. You can still download them from the App Store directly on your iOS device if you bought them through iTunes. They will also still be on your Mac in the Music iTunes Library Tones folder if you already had those installed, and you can actually manually put them back on your device. So we'll talk about that in a second because it also relates to another change, the application change. But one other thing with that's new in iTunes 12.7, Windows users are no longer going to see iBooks in iTunes. They will need to use the iOS app to see those iBooks. So I guess you could do that in the Windows version of iTunes. But as far as the mobile applications and the tones, when you upgrade, those are not removed from your iTunes media library folder or media folder. So if you go into your music folder, into iTunes, and into the iTunes media folder, and look in the mobile applications folder, you'll still see all of your iPhone applications files, the IPA files that have been downloaded prior to the 12.7 update. You can back those up. You can do whatever you want with those, but they're not going to be updated in the future. So as you buy new apps, they're not going to be downloaded into that folder. Same thing with the ringtones. They're in the home folder, music folder, iTunes media folder under tones. And you can, if you don't need copies of all of these things, you could delete them to free up space. They're no longer going to be used by iTunes. So that's a good and a bad thing. I like having actually backups of all of my mobile application files because developers remove them. Apple removes things, and I want to keep copies of those things sometimes. So not going to be able to do that anymore. If you want to keep the stuff that you have, you're going to want to back it up, move it to some archives. The biggest deal here, besides the fact that now you can't browse iOS apps on your Mac, there's really no way to do that, unfortunately. The bigger deal here, I think, is the fact that when you restore your iOS device, you are going to have to re-download every application that is on your iOS device from the App Store. There's no more way around that. In the past, it would actually load it back in from iTunes if you had up-to-date local iTunes copies of those files. So it was always the recommendation, make sure you update all of your apps in iTunes, then do your restore through iTunes while your iPhone's connected, and that way it can quickly load the apps without having to re-download them. That ability is now gone, so just be prepared. If you're doing a restore, it's going to take a long time to pull all your apps back on there, especially if you have limited bandwidth and connectivity. And also be aware, it is going to use a lot of bandwidth. So if you're bandwidth restricted, you might need to go find free public Wi-Fi or something like that to do it. That's kind of not cool on Apple's part. And a lot of us in the community are really curious as to why Apple has removed this. I still hold some kind of hope that there's a plan to maybe bring an iOS app store to the Mac or something like that, where we can manage those things and sync those things. But I don't think that's going to happen either. I think Apple's thinking the cloud is the way to go. The cloud is the future, and that's the way it's going to be. The last question this sort of change brings, though, is what about my apps where I can transfer files to and from my iOS devices and their apps using iTunes? That functionality is still there. You can still connect your device, select it in iTunes, and then there'll be a new area below the on the left-hand side called file sharing. Click on that, you'll find all of your applications in there, and you can pull files off and put files on through iTunes. So that file management thing is still there. But again, you're not going to be able to browse apps from your Mac in the iOS store. That is gone. So just be aware of that change if you have not updated to iTunes 12.7 yet. But one big new feature that iTunes 12.7 brings that you might be excited about, and this is for Macs running iOS 11 or Mac OS High Sierra, is the new Friends feature. So you'll be able to share and follow and see your friends' music and playlists and stuff that they're listening to if they opt into the program. You can also set your profile to be private. So you can either have a profile, not have a profile, or have that profile be public or private. If you're private, you have to approve people to come and follow you. So that is going to be, I think, a good discovery feature. I'm very curious. I have some friends who are very deep and knowledgeable music aficionados, and I would love to see the kinds of stuff that they're into and what they're listening to and use that to kind of discover new music. So it looks like with the Friends feature of iTunes 12.7 that or of the new music app in iTunes, that Apple may finally have cracked social inside their music app. They've tried a few different times with a few different things. iTunes Connect is kind of working sort of okay. And then what was that thing we had a while back? I totally forgotten the name of it. But you know how Apple has not been super successful with social applications. This one actually might work. At least I think it's going to work for me. So let's talk about my thoughts and reactions to a few things that happened during the event, because I've been receiving emails and questions. Kind of the big one was what everybody is calling the Face ID fail. All eyes were on Face ID, right? We had the rumor that Face ID was replacing Touch ID. I was even critical of it. If you go back and listen to some of my past podcasts, I was having a hard time believing that it could be better than Touch ID or faster or better. And so I was very curious to see how Face ID performed. And when Craig Federighi first tried to demo the feature, it didn't work. He picked up the phone and tried it, and it didn't work. He tried it again. It didn't work. And he kind of, you know, he was visibly caught off guard. He was shocked that it didn't work. But being the professional he was, he's like, okay, let's just go to the backup phone. He picked that up, and it worked. Boom. First time, no problem with the backup phone. I'll admit, I was shocked and disappointed. And I also kind of felt, hey, I have vindication that, you know, Face ID is not a good replacement for Touch ID. Look, it just failed for Craig Federighi right there. And I had to step back from that and realize that's not cool. I don't want it to fail. I want the technology to be good. And So then I said, oh, well, you know, it is beta software. It's beta hardware. They're not shipping the phone until October. Things can happen. So they can still work on it. They still can improve upon it. And by the end of the whole presentation, I wasn't too worried about it. Again, also because the backup phone worked so well. Well, turns out that Apple said, look, it wasn't an actual failure. The technology didn't fail. Was actually a feature. What happened was, and I mentioned this earlier, if someone is trying to use your phone and the Face ID detects that, it will, after 5 bad attempts, just like with the Touch ID, it will default back to forcing you to use the passcode. And that's what was going on. Now, why that happened up on the demo model is Apple has people that come up and prep those things beforehand. And apparently it looks like what happened was the person who was supposed to go up and wipe the smudges off and make sure everything was beautiful and pristine unknowingly had accidentally activated and triggered that passcode lockout feature. So when Craig went to pick up the phone, it was in that mode. It was asking him to put in the passcode to kind of re-enable the Face ID. So that's all that happened there. No big deal. And I think we can all kind of move on from that. Now, reportedly, Face ID has always been the replacement for Touch ID. There were these rumors early on that Apple kind of had a plan A and plan B, and that plan A was Touch ID under the glass in the new display. Supposedly that's not the case, at least according to folks who have leaked or talked to John Gruber. He was reporting on this. And so Apple's been working on Face ID for years. It's been, they feel, the natural progression and replacement for Touch ID. I have to say, even after seeing it work, seeing it go, Apple saying it's better, it's more secure, all of these things, I still have concerns about it. But I'm willing to try it before passing final judgment. And I think that's all I ask anybody to do, right? There's a lot of people saying a lot of critical things about Face ID without ever actually trying it. And I've been critical of it as well and skeptical of it. But the reality is I love Touch ID so much. I think it is a great technology. I love using it. It works great for me. Is it perfect? No. Is it flawless? No. And I don't expect Face ID to be flawless, but I want it to be at least as good, if not better, than Touch ID. And I will say, coming away from the demos and actually reading and hearing about the things that people who have been able to see it in action. Now, no reporters were actually able to use Face ID in the hands-on demo thing. They had it set up for the people who were kind of monitoring and managing the iPhones, but every one of them reported that at least for them in this kind of controlled environment, it worked great. Now, out in the real world, things can change, so we're going to have to see. I'm really curious to see how well it works with Apple Pay. My one concern on the Apple Pay side is it does seem to add a step. It seems like you have to show the phone your face, get it to unlock, and then hold it down to the reader, as opposed to a lot of what I do now is take my phone out of my pocket with my thumb on the Touch ID sensor and pay with Apple Pay. So it's not a motion of bringing it up to my face. It goes straight from my pocket straight to the reader, which is typically on the counter. So it's less movement. So I'm expecting a little bit more movement. But our friend Brian Romilly, who's very much into this stuff, and he was at Apple's event, he says that it's so fast, it's so flawless, that it actually is better than Touch ID. And I'm willing to take his word for it until I can actually try it myself. So I'm going to reserve my final judgment for Face ID. But right now, I'm very optimistic about it. I think it actually could be a better replacement than Touch ID. And I think Apple has done a good job addressing a lot of the concerns, as we've kind of talked about. Quick comment on Animoji. I think this is going to be cool for about 5 minutes for me. It's really neat. It's super fun. You know, it's kind of like, I kind of look at it like Photo Booth was on the Mac way back when. It's going to be a thing that is going to definitely, if not sell phones, it's certainly going to upsell phones. So if you go in there and you see you're looking at an iPhone 8 and then someone says, but this one, look at this, you can do this cool Animoji thing. It's the kind of thing that you might go, oh, I'll spend another $100 for that or a couple $100 for that and some of the other features that I'm going to get along with that. So I fully believe it's going to sell and upsell phones. And I also know that the feature is not for me, but the younger generation, my kids and their friends, they are going to be using that stuff constantly. They love that sort of thing. So, I think it's going to be fun, but I don't expect to use it a whole bunch. Now I want to come on something a little bit more, I'm not going to call this serious because none of this stuff is serious, but what's up, people, with the notch rage? The number one critical thing that everybody seems to be saying, at least in the tech community, and even outside the tech community, there seems to be this absolute hate against the notch in the iPhone X, the little sensor bar, the tab, whatever you want to call it. And I'm just going to say, can we like get over this? I'm like done with it already. It's only been a few days and I'm already sick of the complaints, the bad mouthing, it's fine if you don't like it. I'm not saying that you have to like the notch or what Apple has done with the design, but it's just not that big a deal. And there are other options. You can buy an iPhone 8 and an 8 Plus. They don't have the notch. They're awesome updates. They have almost all of the same features as the iPhone 10 Plus. They're a little bit less expensive. And just so we're clear, here's the differences between the iPhone 8 Plus and the iPhone 10. Size, obviously, the iPhone 8 Plus is bigger. If you want a smaller form factor with a large screen, you have to get the 10. The notch, we've already established that. Dual optical image stabilization on the rear camera in the iPhone 10, where you don't get that in the iPhone 8 Plus. The ability to do the portrait effects on the front-facing camera on the iPhone 10, you don't get that with the iPhone 8, although you do get it with the iPhone 8 Plus. Face ID is obviously reserved for the iPhone 10. And then battery life, if you go with the iPhone 8 Plus, you actually get better battery life. Those are kinds of the differences. So you do have an option. You're getting the same processor, same GPUs, image processors, all these other things. So if you hate the notch, don't buy the 10. That's fine. Nobody's gonna care. You don't have to like the notch. And nobody is making you buy an iPhone 10. People are just upset because this is the new edge-to-edge bezel-less screen. It's the cool new hotness. I get that. I totally get it. But it's being way overblown, this issue with the notch. Without a home button, one can argue, because that was like the iconic piece of the iPhone, right? The iPhone was instantly recognizable by the home button, at least until they took the little icon away. With my iPhone 7, you can hardly tell. The button's barely there, right? The home button's barely there. So even that went away. At least with this notch now, you instantly know that's an iPhone. Love it or hate it, Apple has a big brand awareness there, and that's important to them. As much as it is for functionality, and maybe even more in Apple's eyes, I don't know. You know, it's something that's distinct, and if people try to copy it, I'm guessing it may be even copyright. They might even try to go after them. Now, some feel that Apple should have just gone for a small, full forehead, so there should have been a little bit extra bezel at the top, and that's where that sensor bar should have gone, and then you don't need a notch. There's several other competitive Android phones that are coming out with that design. That's fine. Let them do that and buy one of those if that's what you prefer. But, you know, the notches, they do allow certain dynamic information to go in them, things like the time and the status indicators and some of those things. And there's also some views that offer some neat visual effects in that area, like the call indicator. It's going to change the color around the time to indicate whether you're on a call or you've got background processes going on. And that stuff is up in the notch, out and away from the main interface. So I'm totally fine with that, right? If you just had a forehead at the top, that's wasted space. You don't get extra screen to the left and right of it. So there is a slight advantage to actually having the notch, a little bit more screen real estate and information that's up and away from the main interface, and that information can be dynamically displayed. With the deep blacks, when there are sidebars and stuff there, you're going to barely be able to tell. The ears, I think, also give the advantage of you have logical physical swipe points now for control center and notification center. So, you know, on the left-hand side where that little ear is next to the notch, I swipe there and one thing happens. I swipe in the other place. So there is some reason for that notch to be there. It's not just something that Apple didn't think through. In videos, the default is going to be to avoid the notch. So you actually get little black sidebars when you're watching full screen video in landscape mode. double tapping will actually expand it, and then you will be able to see the notch, but you're going to get the choice for that. If apps use Apple's auto layout, which is part of the design features in Xcode, Apple's been pushing that for years. They've been telling developers, use that. It's going to make your life simpler when going between different screen sizes and different phones and things like that. Sounds like if you're using auto layout, there's a safe area. It's not really going to be an issue. Your app's going to automatically adapt, so you're not going to have stuff cut off. If your app uses custom user interfaces and you're not using auto layout and those sorts of things, you may need to adapt your user interface and move things around to deal with the now rounded corners, because there's also rounded corners on the iPhone X and the notch. So some developers are probably going to have to rejigger some things, and at least initially be prepared. There are going to be some apps that you probably go to use where some user interface elements are getting clipped or cropped by that notch, and people are going to go ballistic about that. But again, developers are going to update their apps. They will adapt. Apple has a whole set of new guidelines for this, and it's not going to be that big a deal. Some developers have noted that in Safari, when you're browsing in Safari, Apple will white box the sides when you're in landscape mode, looking at a website. So they already in Safari have kind of coded around the notch. And a few people have said, you know, that looks ugly. If you've got a dark background site, now you've got little white bars to the left and right. Well, the developer actually can use some CSS to define a background color or a background image for their page, and it will fill that space with that color so that you can fix your designs. So websites are going to have to go through a little bit of tweaking and fixing to adapt for the iPhone X. But again, I don't think this is a huge deal. Is it great? No. Is it annoying? Yes. Is it a massive deal like people are making it on the internet? No, 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 no. Apple's human interface guidelines, as far as the notch goes, they do ask developers not to try to hide the notch or do things that specifically call attention to it. Some people are reacting negatively to that because some, again, developers and designers, they hate the notch. They want to be able to design around it. The important thing to remember here is that Apple's human interface guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They're not rules. Your app will not get rejected if you don't follow them. It's just things that Apple recommends people do. And one of the reasons they recommend them is because they feel like they're best practices and stuff like that. But developers can still do whatever they want. And many are going to opt to do things to hide the bar with black bars at the top or bottom. We've already seen some tweak designs, stuff like that. And that's fine. If that's what you want to do, great. You know, do what you want to make your app look the best it possibly can. I think that's all that anybody wants. But, you know, Apple bashing because you don't like the notch, that's really not doing anything. It's not solving any problems. So that was just something that immediately bothered me. And I know I can be critical of Apple of stupid, silly little things, and I'm going to start to try to stop doing that. Be a little more level-headed. You know, we don't need to freak out about not liking the notch. I want to talk something that I thought was really exciting, and I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, is all of the custom silicone, something completely different. All of the custom silicone that Apple is putting into their products now. If you noticed, Apple now designs the CPU, the GPU, the image signal processor, the neural engine, the secure enclave, probably some other chips that I'm forgetting about. And why this is so cool and significant is, and maybe one of the biggest parts of this whole keynote and announcement from a technology standpoint, is Apple's ability to do integration of the software and the hardware when they control both sides of that. It gives Apple an advantage that I think cannot be overstated. It is huge. This, more than anything, puts Apple well ahead of the competition when it comes to a lot of these technologies. This time around, it's the facial recognition. It's never going to be as good on a competing device, at least not anytime soon, because Apple's competitors can't control the hardware and software integration. They don't get a dedicated chip, neural engine chip, that is just designed and tweaked for doing facial recognition. Apple had the ability to build that into the A11 Bionic because they're designing it. Same thing for advances in a lot of the photo features. They can build things into their image signal processor that are specifically there just for their hardware. And that gives them a huge advantage. They don't just dump their artificial intelligence on a GPU, which is what a lot of other people do. And that's a great place to dump that processing. GPU has a lot of power. Modern mobile GPUs are amazing, even off-the-shelf ones. But Apple being able to say, look, we're going to let the GPU do its GPU stuff, and we need this special dedicated optimized thing for artificial intelligence or virtual reality or augmented reality, whatever it might be, we're going to build and design a chip that only does that. It's tweaked, and it may be part of a bigger chip, but it's in there, and we have it just for that. And so, yeah, other manufacturers, hardware manufacturers, can match specs of hardware things like certain kinds of cameras and certain kinds of sensors and certain bits and components and stuff like that. But that alone doesn't get you to this level of it just works or it just works amazingly well. You have to be able to tweak both sides of that. And, you know, keeping artificial intelligence and supporting secure data on the device is only possible because Apple has technologies like the Neural Engine and the Secure Enclave. A lot of their competitors have a hard time matching that, and that's why a lot of their technologies actually sends that data out to the cloud, potentially exposing biometric data, personal data, and information, right? The ability to do it on the device becomes limited because they're having to do more in software and less on a dedicated processor, and that eats up cycles and battery life and all these sorts of things. So AR processing is the same way. It's why Apple's going to have a huge advantage in the augmented reality space. And it's really what enables the kinds of energy efficiencies that Apple is able to achieve. And I fully believe this is why Apple can get LTE cellular in a smartwatch and not have to increase the size massively to throw in more battery and antennas and more components. And, you know, that kind of stinks. So Apple can make an Apple Watch that has LTE that looks exactly the same as the current Apple Watch. And they can do that because, again, they're controlling the silicon. They have their own chip designers and they work with manufacturers who make chips specifically to their specifications. And that is a huge deal. And I think we're seeing huge benefits from that. And Apple's making huge leaps ahead of their competition because of that. And I thought that was pretty cool. So I received an email from Mike because, you know, wireless charging, brand new thing for Apple fans. And Mike has a question I think a lot of people have. I'm going to do my best Jerry Seinfeld, but he wants to know, what's the deal with wireless charging?
Hi, Adam. This is Mike from Hershey, Pennsylvania. I love the podcast. I just got done listening to Apple's keynote on the new iPhone X, and I guess I just had a question that I was hoping that you would cover in your next one or two Maccasts. I guess I don't get the deal with the wireless charging. You still have to plug in the charging device, so the only difference now is I can lay my phone on top of something that still has to be plugged into an outlet. So I guess I'm not seeing what the big deal is, whether I have to plug in the phone, as I've always had to do, or I have to plug in something else so I can just lay my phone on top of it. I still have to have an outlet. Maybe I'm missing something, but I would love for you to talk about this when you get a chance, and maybe I'm missing something and I should be more excited about this. Anyway, again, love the podcast each week. Look forward to it. Take care.
Hey, Mike, you are actually not missing anything. I think you got it down pat. Yep, that's exactly how it works. Your device does need to be on a charging pad. That charging pad does need to be connected to an outlet. So just like you do now with wired charging, you have to charge it in a specific location or a specific area. Obviously, you could take the charging pad with you just the same way you could take a cable with you, but you're going to have to plug it into an outlet, and the device is going to be tethered or attached more or less to that charging pad, or it needs to be on top of that charging pad for it to work. I think the advantage here is, one, you don't have to connect the cable, right? So you save a little bit of time. You can just throw your device down onto the pad. You don't have to put it into a dock. You don't have to line it up. So there's a little bit of hassle saved there, but probably not that big a deal for most people. I think the bigger place where it comes into play is the fact that you can get little top-ups or use charging pads that maybe are in public spaces. So a lot of coffee shops will be adding these in, different places where people use their phones, airports and stuff like that have some of these Qi charging bases and stuff like that. So you don't have to pull the cable out of your bag or anything like that. You could be at a space, and if they offer Qi wireless charging pads or stations built into tables or desks or whatever that might be, I would imagine libraries, universities and stuff like that will have these start to be built in, then you can simply take out your phone, lay it down, and it will start charging. Now, one big disadvantage in my mind is while you're charging, it does need to be on the pad. So if you are in a situation where you want to plug your device in, and this happens to me all the time, you want to plug your device in and continue to use it, say watching a movie because you've run out of battery, it's going to be a little bit more difficult. I guess you're going to have to kind of hold the pad up against the back of the device, or again, just fall back and plug in your lightning cable, because the lightning connector has not gone away on any of these models yet. You'll still be able to plug in that way. So I really think it's a big deal, big option for little top-ups and stuff like that. It does save the convenience of having to connect the cable. So it's a few minor advantages, but again, it's just an option, right? So having the option, I think, is great. Having the ability to do little top-ups, especially that sort of thing, that's going to be a really nice capability. But as far as like being the main way that you charge your device, and is it different than that? Probably not too different, as you noted. So I don't think, bottom line is, I don't think you missed anything there. The big question now, the one that I have been getting emails and asked about on Twitter and other places since the launch event, we're going to get to it. What am I getting, buying, if anything, of these new products, and why, and that sort of thing? So I can tell you right now, I am not in the market for a new Apple TV. The Apple TV 4K, as awesome as it is, I don't have a 4K television. I believe I barely have a 1080p. I think I have a 1080p television. It might be 720p. I don't know. I don't watch that much content on my TV. Until I get a new 4K TV, I don't see the need for a new Apple TV with 4K, nor will I be downloading the large 4K files for my current TV. I will be sticking with HD for a while longer. But I fully recognize that anybody who has a 4K set is interested in 4K content. That is a huge upgrade. I think it's a no-brainer. If you want an Apple TV, if you want 4K, you're going to have to go for that. Apple Watch Series 3, I'm kind of in the same boat on that. I am the type of person, hey, I'm a nerd, people. I don't do a ton of exercising. I probably should do a lot more than I do. But most of the time when I'm out and about, I have my iPhone with me. It's not been a problem with my Series 2 Apple Watch connectivity-wise, so I don't see the advantage of getting the cellular. Of course, there's some other updates in terms of the processor and stuff like that, but once again, I don't really need the altimeter kind of stuff, the barometer, so I don't need to worry about steps and elevation and updated processor. While that would be nice, I don't see paying just for that feature, and battery life seems to be about the same. And again, I'm not really interested in the cellular, nor am I interested in paying another $10 a month on my cell bill, which if you've been listening to the last two episodes of the MacCast, you know that I switched to T-Mobile. Just actually this weekend I did the switch and it went great, by the way. I'll be covering and talking about that on other episodes of the MacCast because I don't want to waste our time with that here. But I'm looking to save money on my cell phone bill, not actually add additional costs. And again, this just isn't for me. It's not that it's not great features. It's not that it is something that should happen and should be there. I think it's fabulous for the people who want that kind of connectivity, and there's a ton of people that are really going to use it. I love Apple Music. The ability to stream Apple Music right to your Apple Watch without your phone is awesome. So I think it's great for a lot of people. It's just not for me. Unfortunately, I found out with my Series 0 Apple Watch, which was the 38 millimeter Sport, that I am way too hard on the face of my watch for anything other than the Ion X glass. So I would have to go with the steel model, which is much more expensive than the entry model Sport editions. So, spending another $700 on an Apple Watch is just something I don't have really the money for right now, nor am I interested in doing it. So that's the only reason. It's either of those two things. It's nothing to do with the technology. It's everything just to do with my preferences and how I use my devices. And I have a feeling that that's the way it's going to be for most people, right? other than people who are just want to have the latest and greatest thing because they just want that, I think a lot of these upgrades, people will analyze them from the practical advantages for them and decide whether or not it makes sense. Now, iPhone 10, absolutely. I am getting an iPhone 10, no doubt about it. Something that I've wanted since Apple came out with the Dual Camera Plus series is I want those dual cameras. I want to be able to use portrait mode. I'm very excited about the camera features and all of the portrait stuff, and the only way to get that is to have the dual camera system. But as longtime listeners of this show know, I absolutely hate the Plus size. I tried to live with it for a year. I did not like it. I like the smaller size. I think the iPhone 7 size that I have now is almost perfect. And it's kind of the perfect balance between size and screen size and the ability to get a basically what amounts to an iPhone Plus size screen in the form factor of my current phone. I'm all in. I'm ready for that. And, you know, the dual cameras and the photography stuff is really great. I'm coming from the perspective of a just casual user. And I got some feedback from Marco, who is a pro user, about his thoughts on the camera system. So I want to share that with you
now. Hi, Autumn. This is Marco LaRousse, and I am the founder and producer at PPN Photo Podcast Network, where I do photography-related shows together with Scott Bourne. You may have heard of him. So I would like to comment on the iPhone X and the new iPhone 8 in terms of the look from a photographer's point of view. Because for many people who don't like to carry around with them a big camera, the iPhone is really the tool where they take their pictures and share them right away. And thankfully, the quality of the phone has gotten a lot better. Now, looking at the new phone, first of all, I'm very happy that Apple sticks to the 12 megapixel for such a small sensor. I think it's good to focus on better quality image rather than more megapixels. So that's good. They said they have better tones, better color rendition, deeper pixel depth, whatever that's supposed to mean. We always have to see in the real world. So I think that step looks good. But there is one thing that really stuck out to me, and that was the portrait lighting mode. Now, computational photography is getting more important, meaning you take the image, but the camera acts as a computer and does a lot of things to the image, whether it's film simulations, it's more dynamic range through double exposure like HDR, where the camera computes the final image to make it look better. And honestly, there's no better computer than having an iPhone with a processing power behind it. So it's great that they're lead of the pack there. Now, the lighting modes to give the image a look, what they showed, you know, where you can completely drop the background, make it all dark, and change the lighting on the face like you have set up some strobes, which I constantly have to do in my job. And it takes time, it's expensive. So if that will work the way they showed it, that would be kind of great. Although I have my doubts how it will fare in real world. But I think that's a move from Apple, which we have to take a close look at and see how well that works, especially, you know, if you have hair on the details. That's, you know, with a fake bokeh on the iPhone Plus, you can still see that fine detail is the enemy of such a thing when you want high quality prints. And this could be the same problem here with the lighting modes, but I'm totally looking forward to that. So with that said, there's only one thing about the iPhone X that I don't like, and that is the little bar, the little black bar for the cameras for the face detection and recognition, which sticks into the otherwise flawlessly beautiful screen. And I wonder, you know, because it shows the image beyond the black bar, so there's a certain amount of the image covered. And for me as a photographer, I just don't see myself to have this eyesore sticking out all of the time. And I don't even know, will there be crop mode? We have 3x2, we have 4x3. And will there be an iPhone X where you get the template where you can cut out that and already in post-processing have your images according to that? Well, I don't know. These are my thoughts. Looking forward to it, what happens on the camera side. So love your show and looking forward to what you think about that.
Hey, Marco, I want to say thank you for sharing your thoughts and opinions on that. Obviously, a lot of us are looking at it from a different perspective, so it's interesting to hear from somebody who's working as a professional photographer what they think of Apple doing this stuff. And I'm totally with you. I, you know, anything that you're going to do virtually, I think it's going to be very hard, if not impossible, to match the real world effect, right? There's nothing that's going to beat analog setting up lighting and stuff like that. In this podcast, I use an outboard analog audio processor because I think it gives a better sound than anything I could do in GarageBand. I know all those tools are in there, and a lot of people use the digital versions, but I like having that real world stuff, and I think it does sort of set it apart. But we're talking about professional versus the average user, and I think these features that Apple is trying to deliver are really about allowing the average person who owns an iPhone to just take infinitely better photos without having to have the years and decades of professional knowledge of someone like you, nor all of the equipment and stuff like that. So I don't feel like anybody's looking for that level of quality. Now, the question then becomes, and I think this is where it gets a little bit muddy, is can a professional photographer use these tools and the stuff that Apple has built in and in a pinch or in some situations get away with it? And I think the answer is becoming more and more yes. And to me, that's very exciting. And I would imagine for someone like you, that's exciting as well, right? If you can get those portrait effects and not have to lug all that heavy equipment around all the time, even if it's just in your own personal shots, you're probably going to opt for that option. And then when you need the quality that you need, you're going to haul the gear out and you're going to do it quote unquote right. Right. So I think Apple's done a very good job. I think as the sensors and the technology gets better and better, it's going to get harder and harder to tell when something's virtual and something's real. But real is always going to trump virtual forever in everything, in my mind. I never make the assumption that we're going to get to the point where a digital character in a movie or a virtual processing on a photo or any of these things are going to replace flesh and blood, you know, tangible metal and steel and light and all of the real things. Anything else is just a simulation. It's a facsimile. It's not the real thing. So we can get close. We can get very acceptable, if not too better than acceptable for most applications, but I like analog things. I will always love and like analog things. So I'm kind of with you there, and that's kind of my thoughts on that part of it. As far as the notch goes, I think I shared a lot of my thoughts on the notch earlier. I will say I definitely appreciate your perspective and opinion, because I know that one thing is that with photos and in the Photos app and stuff like that, when you're displaying them, especially in landscape, you don't get to avoid the notch. So it's not like videos where it comes up and it avoids the notch completely. That notch is going to be cutting into your image. And when you're an artist and you're working on something like that, you want to view it the way you want to view it. You don't want this little thing sticking out into it. So I totally get that. I hope that Apple does build in an option to the camera app and into the Photos app when you're viewing photos, where it's more like the video app, where that is masked out. And then if you want to make it go full screen and have the notch in there, you have the option. But I think the default should be to preserve the quality of the image, again, because it's your image, not Apple's image, and they're kind of encroaching on that with their design. And I totally get that part. Am I upset about it? Am I not going to buy an iPhone 10 because of it? Personally, no, but I could see how someone who maybe is a pro photographer and that really matters to them, they may choose to opt out because of that. So totally understandable. And again, a very great point from your perspective. So I appreciate you sending in your comment. And as far as it goes for me, though, iPhone 10 is certainly in my future. I'm going to be buying one. And I love it for all of those reasons. Face ID, no home button. I think I'm going to be able to adapt to that very quickly. If I hate it for Apple Pay, I do have my Apple Watch. So, and honestly, I use Apple Pay on my Apple Watch more than my iPhone. So for me, I don't think it'll be that big of a deal. But again, I've had assurances that it's probably going to work better for Apple Pay than my Touch ID did. So I'm willing to give that a shot. No matter how you slice, you know, my one complaint, and this is no matter how you slice, dice, or try to justify this part of the iPhone 10, there's just, it's pricey. It's the price on it, I think, is getting to the point of outrageousness. I get that there's a lot of advanced technology in here. I get that it is an amazing, powerful computer. We're hearing in many cases it's more powerful than a MacBook Pro for single core operations when you look at Geekbench benchmarks. Again, I don't think you can compare mobile processors to notebook laptop processors like this, but people do. So we're just going to take that with a grain of salt. But the point is that, again, no matter how you try to slice and dice this thing, $1,500, which is going to be when you add tax and Apple Pay, out the door for a cell phone. When a cell phone now costs as much, if not more, than an iMac, pricing has gotten crazy on this thing. And that's just my opinion on it. You can agree with me, disagree with me, and I think there's many that are going to disagree with me. But yeah, it's crazy. And international customers, we're already hearing from them, they're having to pay the Apple tax. Apple has raised prices. There's not a straight conversion rate across the board. Apple is in this for the profit. And I've never made any mistakes about this on the MacCast. You've heard me say it before. Apple is in the business of making money, as well as making great products. And they will do the things that they need to do to make money. They're driving the price. And this is certainly, and this has been postulated, and I believe it, the big part of the iPhone X is about raising the price ceiling on iPhones and getting us used to paying these kinds of prices so that they can make more profit. It's good for their stockholders. It's good for their stock price. It's good for their bottom line. That bottom line, healthy bottom line, and having a healthy company allows them to do the things that they do, to innovate the way that they do. And so there's a lot of reasons for this. You can love it. You can hate it. It is the reality. I kind of don't like it as a customer. I never want to pay more money. I'd prefer to pay less and get better technology, but that's just not the reality we live in. So I'm not going to get too bent out of shape about it, but I am going to vocally say I think the pricing is crazy for the iPhone. And if I did not do the MacCast, if I was not needing to have this device to kind of review and evaluate the technology, because Apple doesn't provide these to us. Some people think that, you know, we can get demo models from Apple. I'm not in that position. I've got to buy my technology so that I can report on it to you, tell you firsthand experiences, how Face ID works and stuff like that. I would not be upgrading. Now, that's not saying I feel bad about having to buy an iPhone 10, because I certainly don't. I'm very excited to get my hands on this technology. But the reality is if I didn't have to have it for my job, I would probably skip this version. I'm very happy with my iPhone 7. I love that phone. It's plenty fast. It does all the things that I do. Touch ID works great. I feel fine with the security. The screen is fine for me. It takes great pictures. All of these things are perfectly fine. So I would probably save my pennies. I would hold off for another couple generations, because I also think that, you know, Face ID and some of the technologies that are in here, it's Apple's first OLED display. It's their first time with their own GPU. There's going to be little bumps in the roads. There's going to be technology problems and stuff that are going to come along with this. So the first generation of anything this new always has little hiccups, and I fully expect that we'll be experiencing those. And so if you are not in the market currently for an iPhone, I think it's perfectly acceptable to say, you know what, I'm going to skip this generation. I'm going to wait for the next one, and I'm going to save my money this year so that I have it next year, along with any additional funds to actually buy the thing that's going to be really expensive. And I know. So I think, you know, cell phone cycles, we're now on a 2-3 year cycle. I think, you know, there's people with 4 or 5 year old iPhones, and they work great. I have a few in my household. They're perfectly fine. They're perfectly acceptable. And I think that's one of the reasons I asked the question earlier, why does Apple have so many different models out there at different price points? A lot of those are 3 and 4 years old now in terms of the technology. They are still great devices, and Apple's still able to sell them as brand new things. So I think that's a testament to the technology. It's a testament to Apple's operating system. But you know, the reality is these things are expensive. And again, you throw on top of that AppleCare Plus, and this is something that I purchased with my iPhones for the past few years. I'm debating whether or not I should get it this year, but looking at the pricing, it's $199 to add AppleCare to an iPhone X. I believe the price on AppleCare Plus for the iPhone Plus also went up $20 US. It's $149. So $200 to $150 upfront for AppleCare. I think it's still $129 on the iPhone 8. But you have that upfront cost. The typical thing that you're going to replace with AppleCare is probably going to be a screen. It's $29 for a screen replacement, I believe, on the iPhone 8, 8 Plus. We don't know yet on the iPhone 10, but I expect it to be more than that. I wouldn't be surprised if it was more like $60, maybe double the price. So you start adding up the costs, the upfront costs of AppleCare, and looking at, okay, when am I going to use it? How am I going to use it? And sometimes it may make more sense to hold off. I really don't know. I'm kind of conflicted about it this time around. The replacement cost of a screen without AppleCare, at least for an iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, is $169. So if you add $129 plus another $29, you're basically at $160, right, upfront. So you save about $9 if you crack a screen. That's if you crack a screen. If you don't crack a screen, then you're just out $130 or $150 or $200. So I'm in a little bit of a dilemma. I'm going to knock on wood here, because the reality is like I have only damaged a few screens in my lifetime with iPhones, and I've owned a ton of them, and I've paid a lot in AppleCare. So if you're really klutzy, if you're really hard on your devices, then it probably makes sense to get AppleCare Plus. But if you're like me and you have relatively few accidents, it may be better to just pay the out-of-pocket, out-of-warranty replacement cost. Again, we don't know the numbers for the iPhone 10 yet, so my decision may change at that point. And there is the convenience factor, right? Just having peace of mind, knowing that you have it, that if something happens, you're not going to have a big bill, like $400 to replace your phone, that it might only be $99 or $29 for a screen. That can be an advantage as well. So everybody, I think, with AppleCare, you need to kind of weigh the kind of person you are, how you treat your devices, and just whether or not there's value in it for you. Because of the higher cost of the iPhone 10 and possibly the higher cost of the parts, I'll tell you right now, I probably will opt in for the AppleCare just to suck it up and pay the $200 up front. I'll probably end up never using it like I often do, and then just realize I gave Apple an extra $200. But we'll have to see. Might be better to keep that in my pocket and maybe set aside a little fund for replacement devices. So I really don't know at this point. A number of people had asked about AppleCare, and I'm a little conflicted this time around. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you have advice for me, send it along. maccast@gmail.com. With that kind of covers, I think, everything I wanted to say related to the event and the new products and stuff like that. I certainly want to hear your feedback and opinions. What are you excited about? What products are you getting? Why are you getting them? Why are you not getting them? What do you hate? Everything. I want to hear all of your feedback. Please send me some emails. Audio comments are very welcome. If you can keep them down to 2 to 3 minutes, seems to be the perfect length. I always appreciate that, but shoot in your feedback. Let me know what you're thinking. maccast@gmail.com. I know we've got a big, long show going today, but there are a few other things I want to cover. One is just a really cool thing. If you are excited about augmented reality and specifically ARKit, and you're running iOS 11, and you're a fan of pCalc, which is a great calculator app on iOS. If you own a copy of that and you're running iOS 11 and you update to the latest version, here's a really cool thing you can do. It has an augmented reality Easter egg in it. And actually, I guess it's had this Easter egg for a while with respect to 3D and some of the features. But if you go into the info screen and then go into the help section and tap on About pCalc, so on the About screen, you'll see the pCalc logo. Tap on that, and you'll enter this whole new user interface that has like a mini game. It has a 3D environment. You can throw 3D coins and die and all this sort of stuff around there. In that screen now, there's actually an AR button, and you can tap on that and it will give you the ARKit experience. So it will scan for a surface, and then you can interact with all those 3D objects and gravity and stuff like that with the augmented reality ARKit environment. And it is bizarre. It's weird. You can turn on fire. You can throw flaming bananas if you want. you can turn off gravity and watch everything float around in your room. It is just really fun and really cool. And there's actually some practical applications. If you roll a die or flip a coin, it will actually throw those statistics into the screen, and it will be additive. So you can roll a bunch of dice and get the total, all those sorts of things. flip coins and get the totals and percentages and stuff like that, I think. And there's also little virtual pCalc calculators that you can put into the environment, and they actually still work. You can tap on the buttons and actually do calculations in a virtual calculator in your real room using augmented reality. I think I got that right. But it is amazing. And if you haven't checked it out, it's a lot of fun to play with. And it may already be on your phone right now. So play around with that. I had a good time with it. And that was revealed this week when I think iOS 11 hit and the new update to pCalc came out. So find pCalc on the App Store. I forget the price of it. I've owned it for years. It is a great calculator. If you're just looking for a great calculator for iOS, check out pCalc. And then finally, I think because the iOS updates are coming out here very soon, I think macOS High Sierra comes out on the 25th, and we're getting macOS or iOS 11 here on the 19th, and just a couple days on Tuesday, I believe. It's time to start prepping our Macs and our iOS devices for that. And actually, Gary discovered something or thought about something related to that, and he sent in this comment.
Hey, Adam, Gary, wanted to give you a quick voicemail message about my struggle for iOS 11. I think I mentioned it last time that in iOS 10, it kind of was the same situation, the upgrade. So I think the best practice is to do an encrypted backup on your computer before you move to the next operating system. And with that, I have a 256 gigabyte iPhone and a computer that has a 500 gigabyte internal SSD. And I've done what I can to free up space. My libraries are optimized and my phones are optimized. So for music and photo storage, it doesn't seem like it works as well as it should. I did log a ticket with Apple's techs, and they're taking a look at the problem. Like when I go to back up my phone, it should really, I think, create space for itself, because there is a significant portion that's considered purgeable that it could re-download if needed. And on my phone itself, the libraries take up a lot of space, but it's all optimized storage. So basically struggling with that currently, thinking maybe the new norm would be just to move with iCloud backup in place, because I don't think people are going to have computers to store all of that data on. You can't move your iTunes backup to an external drive easily. And I think my only big concern with just moving to the next operating system without an additional backup is my health data. I think in iOS 11, health data will be stored encrypted in the cloud, but I'm not quite sure about iOS 10. So the best measure is to have an encrypted backup. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary, you're welcome. Yeah, thanks for those comments. And actually, I just want to kind of clarify or explain something to people who may be a little bit confused about what you're talking about. So when you're getting ready to update to the next version of iOS, a good idea is to have a full backup of your current device. And if you use iCloud backup, most of your stuff is backed up, but there is a few items, or there are a few items, that don't get backed up currently in your iCloud backups. And as Gary pointed out, health data, the health data that is in the health app is not part of that. That is for security and privacy reasons. And that is, I believe you're right, Gary, I think that is going to be changing with iOS 11 and updates to iCloud. But currently, that stuff doesn't get backed up. And also, any of your sort of network settings, your network passwords and things like that. If you've ever done a restore of your iPhone and only used an iCloud backup, you know that you'll be prompted to re-enter all of that information. But if you connect your device to your Mac through the USB cable, the link to USB cable in iTunes, you can go in, and even if you're using iCloud backup, you can select that device, you can pull a manual backup, and if you check the option to encrypt your backup, if you encrypt it, it will store your health data and your network password data and stuff like that. And then when you go to set up your new device and you restore from backup, it can pull from that encrypted backup in iTunes and pull all of that information back and retain it. So, Gary, it sounds like the problem you're having is you have a Mac that just doesn't have enough available storage for the large backup of your entire phone. And I imagine there's a lot of people in that scenario. So you have a new MacBook, maybe a 256 gigabyte hard drive. You have an iPhone that has, or an iPad that's 256 gigabytes. And guess what? There's not enough space to pull a full backup of your iOS device, at least not locally. And as you've pointed out, with a local backup from iTunes, you cannot change the location that you can store that backup on. Even if you're using your iTunes library on an external device, the default location for that backup is in your home folder on your Mac, I believe in the library folder, in application support, and then inside the mobile, I think it's the mobile sync folder, is where all of those things are stored. I'm just looking on my Mac to see if I can verify that. Sorry, I should have written this in the notes. Yeah, in the mobile sync folder. So it's your home folder, the library, application support, mobile sync, and there'll be a folder called backup, and that has all of your iOS backups in there. So one recommendation I would have if you don't have enough space on your internal drive to currently backup your entire device is see if there's some old backups in there you can get rid of. The easiest way to do this is to go into iTunes, go into the preferences, and then click on the devices tab. And then you should see a list of all of the device backups that are local to your machine. If they have a little lock next to them, that means they are encrypted. And you can select those and you can delete those backups. Maybe that'll allow you to free up enough space on the internal drive so you can actually pull a full backup. The other thing, you mentioned not having an easy way to do a backup to an extra location. If you're willing to spend a little bit of money on a great piece of software, and these guys have been a sponsor of the MacCast in the past, they're not currently, but I still love the app, iMazing. I've mentioned iMazing a few times on the show. iMazing will actually allow you to pull a backup. You can do an encrypted backup, and you can set the destination to any place that you want, including onto an external drive, and they will also let you be able to select that to do the restore from. So you could use also iMazing if you're not able to free up enough internal space on your internal drive. So give that a shot. Good luck with Apple support. Hopefully they can figure out why there's so much extra stuff stored locally on your device. I know one area that is a potential problem is podcasts. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, I believe they cache the files into that purgeable area. And I'm not entirely convinced that it gets purged, nor do I believe that there's any way to force purgeable areas of your device to get purged, you know, for that space to actually get freed up. Maybe there's a trick, though, that somebody in the community knows for doing that, or an app. I just haven't run across one. Maybe, so if somebody has a tip or a trick for that, maybe let us know about that. I wouldn't be surprised if someone comes back and says, Adam, dum-dum, iMazing will let you do that. I have never looked for that feature. iMazing does a bunch of things, and I don't know everything that's in there. So don't. I won't be shocked if one of you says I can do that with iMazing. But as a larger way to finish out this topic, I did just want to comment on steps for preparing for both the macOS High Sierra upgrade and the iOS 11 upgrade. Recommendations are pretty much the same across the board. First and foremost would be if you don't have to upgrade, especially if you have certain devices or Macs that you rely on for business reasons, they're kind of mission critical machines, you may consider not actually updating day one. Like, don't do it the day the update comes out, because there's gonna be little bumps and hiccups and things like that. There could be third-party applications that aren't updated or supported, all of those things. Yes, these things have been very well publicly beta tested over and over. They seem to be very stable at this point. I expect very few people to have issues with these updates, but there's always edge cases. There's always things that happen. There's always things that get missed. And in the weeks after an iOS or an OS update, what you'll find on news sites, and we'll even cover some of these, I'm sure, on the MacCast, is, oh, someone forgot that this critical app doesn't work, or something weird is going on with Office application or Photoshop or some other thing. and you don't want to be caught in that. So if you don't have to upgrade right away, consider waiting. You don't have to wait long, a week or two, and just make sure there aren't any sort of early first adopter kinds of hiccups. A lot of these come with third-party apps and software, so you want to make sure you check online, check with the developers to make sure they're supporting the latest version of the operating system, because nothing is worse than upgrading and then realizing some mission-critical application that you have doesn't work. So somewhat related to that, if you do decide to trudge forward and do the upgrades, my mantra, backup, backup, backup. Make sure you have multiple backups. Check those backups before you do the upgrade to make sure that they're working, that you can recover files from them. If it's a bootable clone, make sure that you can boot from it with your current version of the operating system. Something to be aware of with Mac OS High Sierra specifically is that it is going to convert any SSD boot volumes. So if your Mac has an SSD drive in it as the main volume, that volume is going to be auto-converted to Apple's new file system, and you don't have an option to opt out of it. It's going to get converted to Apple APFS, Apple File System. And while that shouldn't be an issue, it should be kind of seamless to you. Where it might become a problem is some of the cloned backup tools like SuperDuper are, I'm hearing notes, and I think I saw this on the SuperDuper website, that they're not probably day one going to be able to support making a bootable backup of your system. So they're working on that. They're going to get it working. They are going to have support for APFS, as far as I know, day one, but maybe not all of the features. So again, check with the developers, make sure the apps that you rely on, the critical apps, are going to be working completely with the new operating system with all the features that you want to use. So that's a great example of that one. So be aware of those sorts of things. But yeah, make a cloned bootable backup of your current operating system. And I would even advise, if you can, get an extra drive for that. Buy an extra drive, make an extra bootable copy that you can keep to the side, pristine and ready to go. So if you do move over to High Sierra and discover some sort of mission critical problem, you have a way to roll back. Because a common problem I've seen, and I've run into this myself, I forget that, oh, I'm going to upgrade High Sierra, and then SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner is going to run, Time Machine is going to run, and guess what? Now the drives that were for my old operating system are now on the new operating system, and rolling back is very difficult, if not next to impossible. So have a backup that is your old system, pristine, untouched, and I like to have that extra backup and leave it around for a couple weeks, 2 weeks, a month, just in case I've missed something, I need to go back and get something. So that would be my other bit of advice. As far as upgrading goes, I'm a big fan of doing clean installs. We've covered that many times here on the MacCast. So, you know, backing up, making sure your backups work, and then erasing your main volume, installing the operating system from scratch, restoring your user files and documents and stuff like that, but then reinstalling applications from scratch. I use it kind of as a spring cleaning. It takes extra time. It's more difficult to do. But in many cases, I think it's worth it because you're kind of starting from a clean slate. I typically do it if I haven't done a clean update in a while. I've gotten in the practice. I don't do it every OS upgrade, but lately I've personally been having some weird issues with my Mac OS Sierra installation. So I'm probably going to do it with High Sierra. I don't think you have to do it. Apple has gotten a lot better about the ability to do an over-the-top upgrade. So I would say that if your current operating system is running flawlessly, you're not having any issues with it, you're probably safe to just do the over-the-top upgrade again once you have good, reliable backups in place. Sorry to keep harping on that, but I'll tell you, every year I'll get an email from someone who says, look, Adam, I didn't take your advice. I didn't do the backup. Something went horribly wrong. Can you recommend a good recovery tool? And that's the worst email for me to get because, honestly, recovery tools, while they work and can recover data, they don't always work. It's hit or miss. And if you have to send it out for data recovery, it is super expensive. So you don't want to be going to Drive Savers just because you were trying to upgrade your operating system. So there's that. But on iOS, same kind of thing. Make sure you have backups. It's a little bit smoother, less worrisome with iOS. And I've been using iOS 11 beta. It's been great. I just did the Gold Master onto my iPhone because I had been using it on my iPad, which was less mission critical. And knock on wood, so far, no issues. And I've heard nothing but good things. So very excited about the new operating systems. Of course, we're going to be talking about new features and stuff that we discover with those as we learn them and get to use them on future episodes of the MacCast. But I don't want to drag this one on for any longer, I guess. Let's just say that this has been a great episode. I'm happy that it was this long because we had a lot of stuff to talk about. I hope you enjoyed it too. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me your audio comments and your emails. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at MacCast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast or the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.